मेरी हिंदी बहुत कमती है, लेकिन मैं बहुत खुशी हूँ आपका आशीर्वाद आज मुझे बहुत सुंदर है। धन्यवाद। I have had to accept that my life is of some significance, and I am grateful for it, for the fact that I have been able to serve my guru. One of the compliments that I received in my life that I particularly have enjoyed was one time I was talking at a public function, but we were milling about just and talking with people, and I asked this young lady what her name was. We'd been talking, and she told me her name. Then she asked me my name, and I told her Swami Kriyananda. She said, "Oh, Swami Kriyananda, but you're famous." I said, "Well, maybe, but why do you say but?" And she answered, "Well, but all the famous people I know seem important." I was very happy not to seem important. I am a very ordinary person, and yet I have to accept that my role in this life has been, to a certain extent, important to many people. Interestingly, when I was conceived was the year and perhaps even the month that Yogananda acquired Mount Washington, his headquarters in America. And as my mother carried me, she felt God's presence and prayed, "This first child I give to God." But I was rather a stubborn young child and young man. I remember when, at the age of 5, my mother undertook the job of teaching, of trying to teach me. We were living, I think many of you know, I was born in Romania, but my parents were American. And so I'm neither fish nor fowl, neither Romanian nor American. I'm really a citizen of the whole world. And this is how I feel in my heart. In fact, it took me many years to be able to understand the American mentality enough to be able to really relate to it. But when my mother decided that it was time for me to learn, we didn't have any teachers who could teach English, so she began teaching me. And I looked very coldly at her. I said, "Then how do you know? You're not a teacher, you're just a mother." And this was not a very complimentary thing to say, and I'm not proud of having said it. But I do say this, that it actually has been a theme of my life. If somebody wants to tell me something, then I want to know what his right is to tell me. And so my parents had to get teachers from England to come and teach us. And many years later, when I went to school, when I went to college, again and again, I kept feeling these people don't know what I want. They can tell me all kinds of unnecessary facts, but they can't give me truth. And I felt very discouraged, because nowhere that I looked, nowhere that I could I find anybody who knew truth as I wanted it. And I sought truth myself very urgently and with increasing desperation, you might say, that I tried it through the sciences. I thought of becoming an astronomer. I sought it through politics. I thought it through all sorts of things, including music and art and so on. I thought to become a playwright. But always this thought in my mind was, who knows truth? And I wanted to be a playwright, to share truth with people. And I finally said one day, "But I don't know truth. Why should I infect with people with my ignorance?" And so I left playwriting. I left all those ambitions, and I didn't know what to do. And I thought, there's got to be some solution. I had tried to seek truth without God. And I remember one evening I was in Charleston, South Carolina, learning stagecraft to become a playwright. And I remember I took a long walk one evening, and I was thinking, what if there is a God, what can he be? And my answer that I came to was a very Vedantic answer. I didn't know anything about Indian philosophy or Indian culture or anything at all. And I thought, well, God has to be consciousness. And if our consciousness comes from him, then we are conscious only because he is conscious. And our job in life must be to attune ourselves to his consciousness. And I could see in my own life that when I fell away from that thought, I suffered. And when I was more in tune with that thought, I felt happier. And so I resolved that evening, my life will be dedicated to not only seeking God, but seeking attunement with him, seeking to attune my consciousness with his. But nobody I had ever met told me these things. And it seemed to me that I was going maybe mad. I really didn't know. And I looked at the people around me, and I saw that all of them are just like me. And the mistakes that they make, getting into being drunkards or criminals or so many things people do in the name of finding happiness, I thought I could have become that just for a little change. I just know that's not what I want, but I'm just like them in every other way. What is it that we're all looking for? And it was very interesting. My father, as most of you know, many of you know, he was an oil geologist, which is why I was born in Romania. And at this time, he was posted to Egypt to head up an oil exploration firm there by his company, which was Esso. And the day that I put my mother on the ship to join him, mind you, not knowing anything about Indian teaching, Vedanta, gurus, yoga, nothing, nothing. But I knew the truth in my heart. And if they had been in America, it would have been hard for me to make such a sudden change as I did make, because it was altogether the opposite of anything anybody could have thought. But I came upon that same day, I came upon, as Sri Kartikayan talked, Autobiography of a Yogi. It completely changed my life. I knew that here was somebody I could follow. Here was somebody I could trust. It was like an ancient recognition I knew. But how many people have I met since then who have had that same feeling? You know, that book is the best-selling, all-time best-selling autobiography in the world. That's quite the statement, but it's the truth. He's had an enormous impact on people, and most people in this hall, if not all, have read that book. I took the next bus. It took 4 days and four nights by bus to reach Los Angeles. And when I came to Yogananda, the first words I said to him were words I, in my youthful arrogance, would never have said to anybody. But the first words I addressed to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And that was, well, it's beginning my 60th year since that occasion. And I had a certain role to play in his life, and I'm grateful for it. I don't feel I'm worthy. I think I have had that role to play by default. There's no one else who would come up and do it. One of the thoughts that I had in my heart and in my mind as I was crossing the country was, this is such a wonderful truth. Everybody must know it. And I've always had this strange characteristics in my nature that if I see something good, I want everybody to know about it. And so I wanted God for myself, and I wanted to be a hermit. And yet at the same time, I thought, I want everybody to know about it. Well, he tuned into that. And from the very beginning, he started training me for that kind of role. And it wasn't very long before he told me, "You have a great work to do." And I didn't know what he meant by that. But I knew it wasn't a compliment. I knew that it was a charge. It was a duty that he was giving me. And many times after that, he said the same thing. I remember on the Christmas meditation in 1949, used to call me Walter. He said, "Walter, you must try hard, for God will bless you very much." Well, to me, the blessing is to be his disciple. I don't really feel that there's anything else that I want except to serve him eternally. But I do want to know God, yes, of course. But within that desire for God, I feel that his mission, because I have made a great deal of study of it, my desire was to reach everybody. Everybody was not just everybody in Los Angeles, or the way the French say, to Le Monde, meaning maybe a family or two, but the whole world. I just wanted everybody to get in on the act because it's what everybody's looking for. When I came to India in 1958, I was so eager to see this message spreading in India, and I found that it was completely asleep. And it was a great disappointment to me. But I came to Delhi, and we tried to start a work here, in Induji and Kishan and Mr. Beej, all of us tried to create something here, but it was not to be. My guru had another thought in mind for me. And in these years, I have done what I could. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about him, because, as I said, I met many people. I met great people. I was born into a well-to-do home, and I met famous people, and I met all kinds of people. It was sort of my interest to meet people and see what makes them tick. But I had never in my life met a man of such greatness as I saw in Paramahansa Yogananda. It has surprised me to see that his name is not mentioned among modern Indian saints, but he was very great. I can tell you, I lived in India 4 years before I came here this time, and this time we've lived here also nearly 4 years. But I have to say that of all the saints, I don't denigrate anybody, but there was something very special about him. He was so human in a beautiful way. You know, people use the expression, "I'm only human." He wasn't only human. He showed us what our potential is as human beings. He showed us how to be kind and compassionate and loving. Whenever I would look into his eyes, I would see just as if it was infinity. There was such love there, though, but it wasn't a personal love. It wasn't as if I love you personally, but yet it was. He had our interests personally at heart, but the most important aspect of his impersonality was that he wanted nothing for himself. I would look into his eyes and I would see there are no emotions there. There's only that cosmic love. In his presence, sometime he might be talking about very ordinary things, work that had to be done on the driveway and filling of potholes and so on after a rain. But sitting in his presence, I would feel such joy coming over me that I've never known. It was just an incredible thing. He was so forgiving. Somebody once, he was scolding a disciple, and the disciple said, "But sir, you will forgive me, won't you?" And he said, "What else can I do?" But it was an amazing thing, his forgiveness, his love, and yet it wasn't only personality. And this is what I have learned from him. First of all, I thought that it was his strength of willpower, because all his disciples have strong will. And if you can say anything about me, I'm pretty stubborn. But at the same time, it's something more. You know, he used to quote to us, "All of Krishna's soldiers were like Krishna." And there's something, an attunement with him. And this is something I want you all to understand, because it's very important. This ego, which to you seems so central, it seems to be who you are. It is not. That infinite consciousness brought us into manifestation, and each one of us is a tiny little reflection, like glass, fragments of glass in the sunlight. Each one of us reflects his consciousness. And that's why implanted in every human being is that basic central desire for one thing only, Satchidananda. And some people think they will get the happiness they're looking for in things, in money, in pleasure, in all sorts of human things. The capacity for error among human beings is astounding. It can keep people roaming for a long time. I don't want to say how long. A long time. But underneath it all, everybody is looking for that one thing. He's seeking the bliss of his own being. And you know, it's interesting, because you think, "Oh, I'm going to become a great man in business and I'll become a millionaire." He gets his millions. Every time you succeed in fulfilling an ambition, you withdraw into yourself. It takes a long time to understand that disappointment and that withdrawing into the self is your answer. It is not out there, it's in here. We're all looking like that musk deer in the Himalaya, that at a certain season in the year, secretes in a pouch in its navel the fragrance of musk, and it runs everywhere looking where this fragrance is coming from. Sometimes it crashes off the high crags of the Himalaya, and the hunter comes and snatches that pouch and sells it for a very costly perfume. But a poet talking about this said, oh musk deer, if only you had understood that the fragrance you were seeking was inside yourself. And this is what everybody has to come to sooner or later. You've got no choice. The dice are loaded. You have no choice. You have to come to the point finally of realizing that the fragrance you are seeking is in you. I'm not here to convert you to anything except your own self. I want you to know how glorious you are in your potential. Every human being is a potential Krishna, Rama, Christ, Buddha, everybody. They came to this world not to show us how great they were, but to show us our own potential for greatness. We were born for this, and how long will it take? You know, it takes a long time because people keep thinking, well, if I don't find it here, I'll find it there, I'll find it there. And after a long time, they finally say, oh no, it's got to be somewhere inside. It takes, however, I remember one of my guru bhais said, I don't think, Master, said to our guru, I don't think, Master, I have very good karma. And Yogananda said, remember this, it takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. You have good karma or you wouldn't be here. Cling to that. Don't let anything drag you away, because nothing else will satisfy you. Any other fulfillment you get is sooner or later going to disappoint you, and you withdraw into yourself and try to get your strength up again so you can go out and face the noise and the battle again. I'm going to give you later on, you know, I wrote the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, and it's not really my book. It was an amazing thing that happened. When I set out to write, I suddenly remembered every sloka of the Gita that my guru had dictated. And it was a clear memory. I remember many years ago, because I'm not in that organization anymore. And I said to Master in a dream, how can I do this Gita? That what they've done is not what you want. It's not right. There are even not untruths in it. How can I do it? You told me to do this. How can I do it? And I can't get into their archives. I don't have access to the original writings that you gave. What can I do? And in the dream he said, don't overlook the possibility of a skylight. A skylight in the roof where the light can come in. And that's what happened. When I asked him, I suddenly remembered that whole Gita. And I wrote all interpretation for all those slokas. But there was one part I didn't do. And this is something that I want to give to all of you as a present to make up for that lack. The first chapter of the Gita is a very important chapter, but it's so deep, and those who have written in this line of Lahiri Mahashaya, including my guru, they have written up to 100, 200 pages about it. And I thought, that will be such an impediment. We'll never get into the Gita. And so I left that out and just summarized it. But now I am wanting to put out the Gita in a complete, just the slokas, just the stanzas or verses. And in that, I also have written those missing stanzas. I left out the first chapter, and I left out the first 11 slokas of chapter 2. And this is something that I want to give to all of you. And those who do not want to come up and take the time to get it from me, I'll ask somebody to have them to give to you as you leave, because I want all of you to have it. It is an incredible thing. You know, the whole Gita is not, the Battle of Kurukshetra is not just a historical thing, and yet it is a historical thing. It's based on history, and yet there's deep truth in it. It's an interesting thing. When I was in college, I was asked a question in my English class, what my criterion for great literature was. And I wrote something that the teacher naturally could make nothing of, and gave me a flunking grade, but I know I was right. I said that I sense from certain works of great works a light. When I think of the Iliad and the Odyssey, I see a white light. And I don't know what it's all about, but I know it's a great book because of that. And Shakespeare has a great light also, but not so beautiful, more gold and blue. And Chaucer, he's okay, but more brown. Most writers have no light at all. You can imagine what an ordinary professor would get when I turned in a paper saying those things. He just, well, that was how he reacted. But I know I was right, and the same thing is true with the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. You don't know what the Rama is all about, probably, or at least I don't. And yet when I finished writing, I felt so clean. I know that it's a very great scripture. And the same thing with the Mahabharata. It is all an allegory. And I don't go into that allegory in this little thing that I've written now. But I have made up for the lack of those stanzas, those slokas, of the first chapter and the second chapter. And this is what I want to give to all of you with interpretation in the form of parentheses, brackets, footnotes, every kind of way to help it be interesting. And instead of 200 pages, I've made it 20 pages. But I think you will get the point from it, and it's exciting. Every name mentioned in the first chapter of the Gita is not just a catalog of warriors. Every name except the main names, and they too have a subtle meaning, every name is, its Sanskrit root has a deep meaning. And even, you know the story of Draupadi and how when Arjuna brought her back, he had won her, and the mother said, whoever prize you bring, you almost share. And so Draupadi had to marry all five of the Pandavas. Doesn't make sense. There's nothing in Indian history of anybody else being, any woman marrying five brothers. You have androgyny in Tibet, but you don't have it here in India. But what it means is that Draupadi means Kundalini. And each of these Pandava brothers is one of the chakras. And so the Kundalini has to rise and unite with each one of the chakras. And so you'll find this explanation here. Another explanation you'll find is Bhishma. Bhishma stands for the sense of ego identity. And the beautiful thing is that Bhishma has the grace not to die until he himself wills to die. And so there he is at the end of the battle, riddled with arrows. He should have been dead ages ago. And yet he's riddled with arrows, lying on the battlefield, giving an inspiring sermon on the duties of kingship. And then when he's ready, he gives himself into God. This is it, that the ego finally can only be renounced by the ego itself. Only we can give up this ego and say, yes, I want that. I want that greater self. And so again and again you will find in the first chapter, there's this absolutely marvelous allegory that the individual is seeking God, but he's also bound by his past habits. And you've got this war. It takes place in the spine, this war between the upward tendencies and the lower tendencies. And everybody has to win this battle of Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra, in himself, and only then can you merge into God. The goal of life is to finally accept that you are not who you think you are. You say, I know who I am. No, you don't at all. You are the infinite who has taken that little form. And it's not so easy to give it up. You've got your wife, your husband, your children, your grandfathers, your father, your mother, your everybody around you. Those were all those relatives in the Mahabharata. They're all the relatives of your own consciousness. And Arjuna says, I don't want to kill my own relatives because those relatives are a part of his own self. And so the devotee says, well, I may be selfish, but it's me who's selfish. I don't want to give that up. I don't want to give up this lust. I don't want to give up this anger. That's me. And gradually you have to reach the point where you understand it's all. It doesn't matter. Krishna puts it beautifully in the second chapter. He says, there is no such thing as death. There is no one slain. Anything that you kill here in your bad qualities will only resurrect again in good qualities. The same energy you put into being greedy and selfish and angry and all these things, That same energy is redirected toward high qualities. And so, well, when you read this, you will find it very exciting. I couldn't put it in the big essence of the Gita, but now it will be put out in a smaller book of just the slokas. Anyway, this teaching of my gurus, I used to be very interested in what is truth. I wanted to know what is truth. I wanted to know what is life. I thought and thought. I remember my roommate in college saying, "Stop thinking so much," but I couldn't help it. I just had to know, what is it all about? When I came to him, I knew he had the answers. And it wasn't as if I sat there and said, "Oh, gee, okay." I was not a yes man by any means. I challenged him a lot, but he answered my questions. And more than that, I felt in my heart. And I came to understand, and any of you who have doubts, I would like to help you with this too. Because I went through a period of doubt, yes. I never doubted that he was a master. I never doubted he was my guru. But I doubted, what does it mean to be a guru? What does it mean to be my master? And I came to find out that the answer to that is love. If you doubt, you can have 1,000 doubts resolved and you'll still have another 1,000. But when you love, nothing else touches you. And this is what, more than anything else, I used to have a lot of intellectual pride. But when I met my guru, he kept telling me, get devotion. And I soon understood, devotion is the only way. You can have all the answers in the world and it doesn't do it for you. But when you have that love, and it's a beautiful thing, it helps you to feel that same love for everybody. Because you see, all people, they be mafiosi or all kinds of people, and yet they all basically are looking for that same happiness. They just haven't found how to get it yet. Everybody is looking for it. And it may take them even days of Brahma, who knows how long it will take. Because man's capacity for ignorance is endless. But I found with my guru that any thought that I had, he knew it. Many times I would think something and he would tell me, correct me. He didn't just do it to say, you're thinking such. No, no. But when I was thinking something that needed correction, he was always there to help me. And always his way of correcting was to prepare me for a public work. That was the thing he wanted me to do. And it took me a long time to accept this, because although, yes, I wanted to help everybody, I didn't see how I could do it. I just wanted to be there and sort of applaud when they were helped. But I came to see more and more. I remember one day he said to me, except for St. Lin, that's Rajarshi Janakananda, all men have disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me. And he said it with so much power. And I thought, what does he mean, saying that all men have disappointed me? He had good men disciples. But they were, difference between men and women is that men are outward in their energy, women are more inward in their energy. And he wanted men who could take this message out. And all of the men who came to him were just sort of thinking of their own liberation, their own salvation. Nobody had the idea of what his mission was for. And by God, I did have that. And so I swore, I vowed, I will certainly do my best. And I have done my best in these years. It has been not easy. I have had many tests. I remember this one astrologer in Germany looking at my horoscope saying, I don't know how we can live with that horoscope. So many obstacles, so many crosses to bear. And yet, I have to say it's been a very easy life. I say, what obstacles? Because in everything that has happened, it's always brought me closer to God. I have just said, as Arjuna said in chapter 2 of the Gita, I am your disciple. Teach me. Tell me what I must do. And what he told me to do, I have done my best to do. And I am grateful to have been here now this is my 60th year. I'm grateful to have come to the point where I can say, yes, I have done my best. I haven't always done well, but I've done my best, and that means a lot. And I'm grateful for all of you, because you are my justification for everything that he told me to do Everything that he brought to people. He came to the West. I have come to India to bring him back here. And I pray through all of you that this will happen. I do not want this work to be an American work. As happened in Italy, we went to Italy as Americans. But now more and more Italians have come and they're taking over. And I want that to be the case here. So that maybe we can all go back to America, I don't know, but this is my home. And I'm very happy to be in India. I feel that what we need, one thing I remember, Master, he was a very powerful speaker. But one talk he gave was the most powerful I have ever heard in my life. It was, strange to say, at a garden party in Beverly Hills. Well, Beverly Hills is a place where there are many very worldly people, big Hollywood stars, rich lawyers, that sort of thing. And in this garden party, he was invited by one of these people. He spoke with so much power. I don't know, he was not invited back, and it didn't surprise me. But he spoke with so much power, he was saying, "You young people must go north, south, east, west, everywhere to spread this message of self-realization and to build colonies where people can live together." Now just think about people in this world. They think, "Oh, I love my family." Yeah, do you? I hope you do. I know that many people do. But I must also say, I am appalled to see how many brothers will sue brothers, how many children don't take care of their ailing parents. I heard a case just the other day in America of a woman who sued her son, age 50-something, got a massive stroke and can't speak and can't act properly. His mother tried to sue him for everything he had. Can you imagine a mother doing that? But that's family. Huh, family. Well, I have a brother. He lives 100 miles away from where I live when I'm in America at Nevada City, California. I never see the man. He's not interested in these things. People who love God are my family. That's what Jesus said. Who is my mother and father and brother and sister? Save those who love God. You are my family. And the wonderful thing is that he was urging people to start communities. It's a simply obvious thing. If you want to seek God, why not live with other people who want to seek God? But of those 800 people or so who were there that day, I'm the one who took up the flag and started communities. And I've started 8 communities so far, and I hope to start one soon here in India. I've started something of a community. We have some Indians living with us, but I want to start it so all of you can come. I want to have businesses so that you can support yourselves. In fact, I'm working on solar energy and alternate energy. And it looks like we may have a very big thing. The reason I came up with this is that Satya Paul, who started about 80 schools, I went to visit him, and he said that he was an industrialist, and with the money he made, he was able to start the schools. And I thought, well, that's the way to do it. We've got to earn money. Here I am, a sadhu. How do I earn money? Well, I had this idea for starting solar energy. And it looks like these people who are doing it are going to be able to create a very big business. And it may help all of India. I pray to God it will. But this will be one job that we can offer people who come to join our community. And I think that it will be a very big thing worldwide. I can't give you the details now. I would actually like to. But I will be asking Amal and Ruby to come up here and talk a little bit, not right now, but in a few moments, to come up here and talk about how we can start communities. Please think about it seriously. All of you live in the world. You have neighbors. Do those neighbors share your desire for God? Maybe, but maybe not. You have people you work with. Do they want God? Maybe, maybe not. In fact, you can't really talk about your own private spiritual practices to the world because they'll only laugh at you. But if you live with people who love God, you know, this is next year we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary. We're already in our 40th year of the founding of Ananda. And now we have about 1,000 people living in our communities in different places, including Assisi, including different states of America. And this is an absolutely thrilling thing to find, that you don't see anger, you don't see jealousy, you don't see people talking against each other. You find kindness and harmony and support. And if somebody doesn't have a job, they all help him to get a job. And if somebody makes a mistake, everybody tries to help to correct him. They don't just gossip about him. It is a wonderful place to live. I say, my own very sincere opinion is that this is the most important thing happening in the world today. Because this example will make people think it is possible to live with others in peace, harmony, brotherhood, and happiness. And I want to start that in India. I want, instead of villages where people just live together and fight together, instead of families where people manage to get at each other's throats, I want a family, even 1,000 people in that family, but people who really love God. And because they love God, they see God in one another. And because they see God in one another, they help each other. When somebody goes to the hospital, they go and try to help him. They all pray for him. When a couple get married, they offer them things so they can go and have a honeymoon or settle down comfortably. Everybody helps everybody else. It's a fantastic way to life of life. And we, to us, we take it for granted. But I would like to show just one example. People come to us from all over the world. Just recently, I think it was 20 people came from Taiwan. People come from everywhere to our village to see, well, how do you do this? I would like them to come to Pune, Delhi, other places, and let them see such communities. I beg all of you to think seriously about getting together in communities. It will be something that you don't have to live in abject poverty. We can have businesses where we support ourselves. We who don't make much in Ananda, we travel all over the world. You'll be surprised how much you can do when you live simply. Anyway, I would like, before I go on, to ask Ruby and Amal to come up and talk about their idea for how we can start communities in India. And thank you all.